worse. And maybe that's the way it's got to be. Maybe I shouldn't say anything at all about the folly of trying to put things to right. But simply on the principle of Blake, let the fool persist in his folly so that he will become wise.
Will this be an argument against conservationists?
This is an argument against all kinds of do-gooding. In other words, what I'm saying is, don't take me too seriously. I'm pitching a case for the fact that the civilization has been a mistake. That it would be much better to leave everything alone. That the wild animals are wiser than we, in that they, putting it in our crude and not very exact language, they just follow their instincts. And if a moth mistakes a flame for the signal on which it gets a mating call and flies into the flame, so what? That just keeps the moth population down. And the moth doesn't worry. You know, it doesn't go buzzing around in a state of anxiety, wondering whether this sex call is the real thing or just a flame. It doesn't think consciously about the future. At least we suppose this is so. Maybe it does, but we suppose that it doesn't. And therefore, it isn't troubled. But the species of moths goes on and on and on. And it's, so far as we know, it's been around for an incredibly long time, and maybe even longer than we have. Bees, ants, creatures of this kind, they have long since escaped from history, so far as we can see. In other words, they live a settled existence, which you might consider rather boring, because it doesn't have constant change in the way that we do. They live the same rhythm again and again and again and again, but because they don't bother to remember it consciously, it never gets boring. And because they don't bother to predict, they're never in a state of anxiety. And yet they survive. Now we, who look before and after, as Emerson says, and predict, and are always concerned whether this generation is going to be better or worse than the one that came before, we are tormented. And we just don't realize, because of this tremendous preoccupation with time, we don't realize how beautiful we are, in spite of ourselves. Because, you see, the conscious radar is a troubleshooter. It's always on the watch out for variations in the environment which may bring about disaster. And so our consciousness is, from one day's end to another, entirely preoccupied with time and with planning and with what has been and with what will be. And since troubleshooting is its function, we then get the general feeling that man is born to trouble. And we ignore in this preoccupation with conscious attention how marvelously we get on. How, for most of the time, our physical organs are in a fantastically harmonious relationship. How our body relates by all sorts of unconscious responses to the physical environment. So that if you became aware of all the adjustment processes that are being managed spontaneously and subconsciously by your organism, you would find yourself in the middle of great music. And of course, this occasionally happens. Well, the mystical experience is nothing other than becoming aware of your true physical relationship to the universe. And you're amazed, thunderstruck, by the feeling that underneath everything that goes on in this world, the fundamental thing is a state of unbelievable bliss. Well, why not? Why else would there be anything happening? Because if the game isn't worth the candle, if the universe is basically nothing but a tormented struggle, why have one? Hasn't it ever struck you that it would be much simpler not to have any existence? It would require no effort. There would be no problems. So why is there anything going on? Let me say, not why, but how is there anything going on? Because if it's all fundamentally a drag, I just don't see any reason for its being. Everything would have committed suicide long ago, and to be at rest. Abu Ben Adhem, may his tribe decrease by cautious birth control and be at peace. So, we might work on this possibility, then, that civilization is a mistake, and that we've taken completely the wrong track, and should have left things to nature, as it were. And of course, this is the same problem that is brought up in the book of Genesis. Actually, the fall of man in Genesis is his venture into technology. Because in the Bible, the Hebrew words for the knowledge of good and evil are connected with technics. What is technically expeditious and what is not? Words connected with actually metallurgy. And to be as God, you see, when you eat of the fruit of the tree of knowledge and you become as God, means you think you're going to control your own life. And God says, okay, baby, you wanted to be God, you try it. But you, the trouble with you is you've got a one-track mind. And therefore you can't be God. To be God, you have to have an infinitely many-tracked mind, which is, of course, what your brain has, you see. The brain is infinitely many-tracked, but consciousness is not. It's one-tracked. As we say, you can only think of one thing at a time. And you cannot take charge of the universe with that kind of a consciousness, because there's too much of it. As I explained before, too many variables. And our science can take care of a few variables, or of an enormous number of variables, as in quantum mechanics, by statistical methods. As we can use statistical methods to predict that most people will live to be 65 years old, at least, but we cannot say of any given individual whether he will live to 65 or not. That's what we wanted to know. But the problem is that the variables on each individual are too complicated. And we have not yet, you see, developed a science which can deal with, say, 50, 100, or 500 variable systems. It's too complicated to think about. The computers are going to help us. But as yet, we're either on the low number or the extremely high number. And these are outside the range of the problems with which we are really concerned. That's why, for example, a lot of people have taken to using the I Ching, the Book of Changes. Because if you're tossing a coin to make your decisions, and everybody does fundamentally make their decision by tossing coins, it's better to have a 64-sided coin than a two-sided coin. The I Ching gives you 64 possibilities of approach to any given decision instead of just two, yes or no. It's based on yes or no, because it's based on the yang and the yin. But in the same way that computers, digital computers, use a number system which consists only of the figures 0 and 1, out of which you can construct any number. And this was invented by Leibniz, who got it from the Book of Changes. It's amazing how this book is somehow always with us. But this, then, is a way of arriving, of helping your own multivariable brain arrive at decisions, cooperating with your own mind. Because then again, after you've tossed your 64-sided coin, the oracle that you read that explains each particular hexagram in the Book of Changes is a sort of Rorschach blot. It is a very laconic remarks into which everybody reads just exactly what they want to read. But that helps you make a decision by the fact that you don't really have to accept responsibility for it. See, then you can say, it told me. I consulted the oracle. Same way when you go to a guru. You say, my guru is very wise and he has instructed me to do this, this, that and the other. But it was you who decided on this guru. How did you know he was a good one? See, you gave him his authority because you picked him out. It always comes back to you. But we like to pretend it doesn't. But the thing is that oneself is certainly not the stream of consciousness. Oneself is everything that goes on underneath that, and of which the stream of consciousness is a mere, well, it has about the same relation to oneself as the bookkeeping does to a business. And if you're selling grocery, there's very little resemblance between your books and what you move over your shelves and counters. There's just a record of it, and that's what our consciousness keeps. Now, supposing then we work with the argument that we've made an awful mistake in bringing out civilization, and we're not going to survive. Now, there are various things that can be said about this. Just as I made the joke that all stars used to be planets, one could say, well, is it such a good thing to survive? You know T.S. Eliot's Wasteland, where it says, this is the way the world ends, not with a bang, but a whimper. But some people would rather end with a bang than a whimper. Some people are stingy, and they like to burn up their fire very gradually, conserving the fuel, and just keep enough heat going so that they get a long time. Other people prefer a kind of a potlatch situation, where they have a huge whiz-bang fire that goes out in a hurry. Now, who is right? Do you want to be a tortoise? You know, a tortoise that lives for hundreds of years, but drags itself around all the time, very slow, 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 solemn? Or would you rather be little hummingbird? Yeah, yeah, hummingbird, that's the thing. See, that dances and lives at a terrific pace. Well, you can't say one is right and the other's wrong. And so there may be nothing wrong with the idea of a world, a civilization, a culture that lives at a terrific increasing pace of change and then explodes. That may be perfectly okay. My point is that if we could reconcile ourselves to the notion that that is perfectly okay, then we would be less inclined to push that button. It's the anxiety. If you cannot stand anxiety, and if you cannot simply be content for issues to be undecided, you are liable to push the button because you say, let's get it over with. People who have trouble with the law and are manipulating the courts in one way or another always learn to delay everything, put it off, introduce legal red tape. managed to, like Ralph Ginsberg, who's been in trouble because of the Eros magazine, he's got a very smart attorney who simply, although the case has gone to the Supreme Court, he's simply mumbling away and putting up all sorts of things so that he keeps Ralph out of jail. And that's life. Life is simply a way of postponing death. And that's what we have to do. So then, let's say, well, civilization wasn't really a mistake. It was just as natural as anything else. A being that exists under conditions of illusion, that imagines that it's controlling its own destiny, that thinks it's capable of improving itself, and by virtue of this illusion, destroys itself rapidly in an interesting way. You see? Let's suppose that's what we are. But you still come back to the point that you are spending an enormous amount of energy in doing things that can't be done. That is to say, tugging at the bootstraps. And if you find this frustrating, if you really don't like it, you don't have to do it. You can stop. And the paradox is that when you stop, you become happier and more energetic. People always wondered about the Calvinists, because Calvinists believed that from the beginning of time, God had foreordained who was to be saved and who was to be damned. And you have no choice. Predestination. Therefore, the logical assumption would be that people who believed in predestination would be laissez-faire. They'd just sit and wait. There's nothing we can do about it. But Calvinists were quite other than that. They were very energetic people. Too energetic. Very vigorously moral. They gave us the Protestant ethic. But they believed in predestination. Because, you see, they simply had all the psychic energy which Catholics were dissipating upon wondering whether they were saved or not. See? And being in a state of fear and trembling about, have I made the right decision? Did I act rightly? And so on. So they didn't have as much energy as the Calvinists. So then in this day and age, we say, in the line of thought of psychiatry or of most schools of psychotherapy, it's important for you to accept yourself rather than to be in conflict. Get with yourself. But everybody says but, because nobody dares take that too far. There's always a little bit of reservation on the end of it. It's like I've never heard a preacher to this day give a sermon on the passage in the Sermon on the Mount which begins, be not anxious for the morrow. They do occasionally refer to it and say, well, that's all very well for Jesus. But the actual putting into practice of this, nobody will agree with. They say it's not practical to not give a damn about how you're going to provide for the next day's meals and all that sort of thing. But it is practical. It's much more practical than what we're doing. If you mean by practical that it has survival value. Only, I want to point out that this is a kind of a two-step way. You see, the first step is not being anxious for the morrow. Not dreaming for one moment that you can change anything or improve anything. Which of you, by being anxious, can add one cubit to his stature? You see? But this, just like the belief in predestination, has an unexpected consequence. Namely, the making of the energy available. So that, in fact, you can take care of the morrow, but for the simple reason that you're no longer worrying about it. And thus it comes about that people who do not live for the morrow